One of the privileges I had growing up was that I had the best of both worlds, country living and city living. I grew up on one corner of my grandfather's farm in a subdivision there, and yet 5 miles from my home was Michigan State University with 50,000 students. Any Spartan fans out there? Okay, we got some. Okay, very good. Sometimes you have to look far to find them. One day, one of the neighbors' father brought home a pet, an unusual pet. I'm not sure where he found it, but it was a stray, and it was in need, and he brought this home for his two sons, two of my friends, Scott and Marty, and this pet was a raccoon, a baby raccoon needing a home. And we went through the ritual of the eyedropper, and then as the raccoon got bigger, all the different things we did to care for it, and Scott and Marty kept it indoors, and it was just a wonderful pet for a while. You know, raccoons are cuddly and furry, and they're fun to play with, and they explore, and they crawl around, and everything was going great until Ricky Raccoon got a little bit older, and then he developed a really bad habit. The habit that Ricky Raccoon developed was that he would bite people. You see, there was something in that raccoon that all the change in environment couldn't change about him. He was really a wild animal. What we call instinct began to take over as that raccoon got older. Now, you'd think that that wouldn't happen because, you know, he was raised in a good family. That raccoon had two of the best parents in Scott and Marty Bragdon that you could ever imagine. He had all that he ever wanted to eat, a nice roof over his head, shelter. The raccoon had it made, and yet for some reason as it got older, it began to develop through those instincts an aversion to being around people. It didn't want to be around. It would bite when they tried to pick it up, and eventually the raccoon had to be released into the wild. You see, there was something internal inside that raccoon that would not allow it to live in an environment with a natural enemy. In the same way, we have been brought into a new family. Through Jesus Christ, we have been changed from the inside, and we've been adopted into the best family in the world. What better parents could anybody have than Jesus Christ, God the Father? And we've been given a new home, the church, where believers under the power of the Holy Spirit gather together to support and encourage one another. And yet, we still find that throughout life we face problems. And you'd think that being in God's family, we wouldn't have those problems. And oftentimes we view our problems as being primarily external. If everybody else would get things right, my life would be easy. If all the stuff on the outside would take care of itself, my problems would go away. And yet, you know, as you live for a while, you begin to discover that many of the enemies that we have are actually internal. That those things which sabotage our life and our relationships are things that are from the inside of us, not from the outside. Paul calls this the sin nature. He says there's a problem that is inherent, instinctual in all of us, which is called sin. And we have a tendency to allow that sin to dominate in one way or another, and it really destroys our lives. Let me give you some examples of that sin nature. Pride, selfishness, lust, anger, greed, self-indulgence, self-pity. These sins on the inside are our internal demons, if I could use that term. Now, when I say demons, I'm not talking about the supernatural type of demons, which I do believe exist. What I'm referring to by demons are those things which live inside of us. They're our sin, and my sin might be different than yours, and your sin might be different than mine, but it's a perpetual, instinctual sin that we can't defeat. seems like it keeps coming back up over and over again. We struggle with it. We try to get rid of it, but it doesn't go away. And that is the thing that determines our life. It drives us. It controls us. It dominates us. And ultimately, it destroys us. In order to live the life of faith, we have to allow faith to overcome our internal demons, our sins that sabotage our lives. The hero of our story, Abram, is a man who we see in this particular story overcomes his internal demons, his internal sins, in order to follow God in faith. And we see how faith was working in his life to allow him to let go of those and embrace the plan that God had for his life. That's the question that we're raising this morning. What are those things inside of you that hold you back, that are constantly sabotaging your life, your relationships, your forward progress with God? As you expose those by faith, you can grow and allow the Holy Spirit to release those out of your life. Let's identify those personally this morning as we see what happens with Abram. Turn to Genesis chapter 14. In Genesis chapter 14, the conflict is primarily an external conflict, something that takes place on the outside, and yet when we look closely at the text, we find out for the man of faith, he's got at least three internal demons that he must defeat, three internal battles or wars that must be beaten inside of him before he can move forward. Chapter 14, verse 1 and following gives us a lot of history, and I'm going to move through it fairly quickly. You get your fill here of ancient Near Eastern names. At this time, Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Kedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, went to war against Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shem-Eber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is, Zor. All these later joined forces in the valley of Siddim, the Salt Sea. For 12 years they had been subject to Kedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. Here we have an international incident. What we have are four kings that are in the Fertile Crescent area, the place that we would call modern-day Iraq. In fact, the place where Abram originally came from, the area of Ur of the Chaldeans. In that area, there are four kings that have banded together to form an alliance, and they have had, for a period of time, 12 years, the kings of the Jordan Valley, that is, the kings in the area where Sodom and Gomorrah are, they've had those kings paying tribute to them. What they used to do in the ancient days was that if you could get together a big enough army, you would march down, and you would tell the people in another area to pay tribute. And as long as those people would send a certain amount of groceries every year, gold and stuff like that, then you'd leave them alone. But any time they decided that they weren't going to send their tribute, then you'd come in and wipe them out. And that's what's going on here. For 12 years, the kings in the Jordan Valley, the kingdoms of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the other three kings, had been paying tribute to Kedorlaomer and the four kings on the other side in the Euphrates area. And on the 13th year, they didn't send the money. They said, we don't need to do this. We're not going to do this. And so in the 14th year, Kedorlaomer and his crew come marching around the Fertile Crescent into the land of Palestine to make these people pay and place them back under subjection. Here's how the battle goes. In verse 5, in the 14th year, Kedorlaomer and the kings allied with him went out and defeated the Rephaites and Ashtaroth, Carnaim, and the Zuzites in Ham, and the Emites, these are my favorite, the Emites, or if you've got the NAS, it's the Emin, the Emites in Shaveh Kirathaim, and the Horites in the hill country of Seir as far as El Paran near the desert. Then they turned back and went to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and they conquered the whole territory of the Amalekites as well as the Amorites who were living in Hazazon Tamar. They're defeating all the people around, you know, the people that we're very familiar with from our history classes in high school.
Right.
You didn't study this in high school. What's the world coming to? Verse 8. Then the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zeboim and the king of Bela, that is Zor, marched out and drew up their battle lines in the valley of Sidim against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, title king of Goim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. Here's the showdown. Sodom and Gomorrah, their kings and their troops and the other three are on one side, and here come the four kings on the other side, and they're ready to go to war, and the battle doesn't last very long. Verse 10, Now the valley of Sidim was full of tar pits, and when the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some of the rest of the men fell into them, and the rest fled into the hills. The four kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food. Then they went away. Verse 12, they also carried off Abram's nephew, Lot, and his possessions, since he was living in Sodom. Now, where was Lot when we last left him in chapter 13? He pitched his tent where? Near Sodom. But it appears that the lure of city life has been appealing to him, and now he's actually moved into the city. In other words, this Bedouin clan that Lot was the head of has now joined with the city of Sodom, and he's actually incorporated himself into the city. In fact, we're going to find out later that he fit right in with the culture. He was part of the city. And if we recall from chapter 13 last week, the city of Sodom was described as a place that was greatly wicked. In fact, their evil was so bad that it got God's attention. God was paying attention to the evil of this city. We'll find out in chapters 18 and 19 exactly what kind of evil these people were involved in and how gross their evil was. But Lot now, Abram's nephew, who last week picked the best part of the land, has moved into Sodom, and guess what? His choices are starting to come back and haunt him. He made a bad choice, and it's beginning to have a terrible effect on his life. Let's see what Abram does. Verse 13. One who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. Now this is the first place in the Bible that the word Hebrew is used. Abram is called the Hebrew for what reason? By the way, the word Hebrew comes from some derivative of Eber, since they were descendants of Eber. And I don't know why Eber was particularly important, but that's how the name got there. Abram is now interacting on an international level. Now, today we read these names of these civilizations and these kings and we think nothing of them, but at that point in history, they were the most important men in the world. And now Abram, in his small clan, is going to be interacting with the kings of the world. He's called the Hebrew to identify who he is and who his people will be. Remember what God said? God said, I will make of you what? A great nation. And I will bless you. And I will make your name great. Is there a person on the face of the earth today? Well, maybe a few, but not many, who when you say the word Hebrew, they don't know about the nation of Israel. And most people would be able to identify the father of the nation as Abraham. God's fulfilling his word. Verse 13. Now Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre the Amorite, a brother of Eshcol and Aner, all of whom were allied with Abram. So now he's made friends in the land. There are four other clans of Amorites here, three other clans of Amorites, and he's gotten in with them, and the four of them have kind of formed a covenant or a treaty together, and that's going to pay off for him. In verse 14, when Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the people. Now, Abram, along with the three other men, the three other clan leaders, gather up a small army. Abram's got 318 men who are trained in his household, part of his clan, that are able to do battle. Now, if we assume that the other three men, Mamre and Eshcol and Aner, have about the same size clan, and they're going with him to fight, we might be talking somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1,200 men. Not even a drop in the bucket compared to the armies of Chedorlaomer and the kings I mean, this is an international military force, and here you've got a group about 1,200 strong, possibly, who are going to fight them. But here we see possibly the first guerrilla warfare in history. What does Abram do? He divides up his men, he attacks by night, and he routs the enemy. God gives him the victory. You say, well, how can he do that with only 318 men? Well, he had 18 more than Gideon had. Look what Gideon was able to do. When God is moving behind the scenes, a tremendous victory is won, and Abram recaptures all the people, including Lot, and he brings them back. Then we see the confrontation, verse 17, and Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer, and the kings allied with him. The king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, that is, the king's valley. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High who delivered your enemies into your hands. Then Abram gave him a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abraham, give me the people and keep the goods for yourself. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord Most High God, creator of heaven and earth, and have taken an oath that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or a thong of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, I made Abram rich. I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten, and the share that belongs to the men who went with me, to Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them have their share. Two kings come to meet him in the valley. One king, Sodom, the king of Sodom, comes out and he makes him an offer. I've got a great deal for you. You keep the stuff and give me the people back. Well, now, according to the right of possession, who could keep the people and the stuff? I mean, at this point in time, the king of Sodom really has nothing at all. And Abram looks at his offer. And then another offer is made by a man that comes seemingly out of nowhere, Melchizedek, a priest of the Most High God. And the offer he makes to Abram is entirely different. The offer he makes is to give credit to God for winning the victory and trust that God is the one working in your life. Now, these two various offers represent significant dilemmas for the man of faith. Before we look at that one, which is kind of the capstone, there are two other dilemmas, or two other internal demons that I think Abram has to defeat in order to get to this point, and in order to win the battle that he wins. The first one that Abram deals with is that faith wins the internal war of past bitterness. Faith wins the internal war of past bitterness. Though the text does not specifically tell us about Abram's personal and interpersonal struggle with his relationship with Lot, it isn't hard to speculate that there must have been some feelings on Abram's part of resentment for what Lot had done. Remember in chapter 13, Lot and Abram stood on the mountain and realized that they had to part company. It was obvious to the two men that they couldn't stay together. Abram, however, was the one who was given the promised land. It belonged to him. It was his land. He was the one who Lot, the nephew, followed to the promised land. Because of Abram's greatness, Lot had also acquired wealth, and he'd become rich. And when they stood on the mountain, and Abram said in his magnanimous way, you pick the place where you want to go, Lot looked around and studied the horizon and picked the best possible land, the richest, most fertile, most well-watered land for him. Selfish choice, but he picked it. And Abram went the other way. Now, I've got to believe that as that patriarch walked off of the mountain, there had to have been in him a level of hurt, a level of sadness. Like, how could you do this to me? I mean, why would you be so selfish after all I've done for you? And yet you pick what you think is best for you and just ignore where I'm at. You know, oftentimes hurt quickly turns to anger, and anger turns to bitterness. And we all know what that's like, because each one of us have been severely disappointed by somebody in our lives. Over the course of our lives, we have suffered hurt from the hands of a family member or a friend. somebody that has done something to us in a selfish moment, sinned against us, and we've experienced tremendous pain. And because of that pain, oftentimes we move from pain to anger and then to bitterness. And bitterness has a tremendous effect on our lives. You see, that demon of bitterness can spring up inside of us and just sap all of our life, sap all of our energy. There's an ancient Greek legend about an Olympic athlete who expected to win the gold medal back in the ancient games of the first Olympiad. And this ancient Greek runner came in second. Now, the city that he represented also had the winning runner. And guess what? Nobody cared about the second place guy. Everybody focused on the winner. They praised the winner as the hero. He was the greatest athlete that city had ever produced. And the man who came in second was a nobody. Nobody cared about him. The people were so enamored with the gold medal winner that they even erected a statue in the town square to honor this great man for winning this race in the Olympics. Now, the second place runner just couldn't deal with that. I mean, he trained and set his heart on being first. And he trained and set his heart on being recognized, and nobody cared about him. And he began to become angry and bitter toward the first place winner. He came up with an idea. Well, I know how I can get back at him. I'll destroy his statue. And so every night, he would go out and chisel away a little bit at the base of the statue with a view that nobody would really notice over time that he was wearing away at the statue, and eventually the statue would crumble. This was a great plan, but it consumed his life. If you're chiseling at night, it's pretty hard to carry on a life in the day. And every night, that churning bitterness would be grinding in him as he pounded away at that statue. One night, however, he chiseled a little bit too far in the wrong place, and the statue gave way. And guess where it landed? The next morning, when the people of the town came out, to their surprise, the statue was laying on the ground, and underneath the statue, dead, was the second place finisher. Consumed by his own anger, he killed himself with it. Someone has said that hate is an acid that can do more damage to the vessel in which it is stored than to the object on which it is poured. Isn't that true? Buddy Hackett says, I never carry a grudge because while I'm angry, the people that I'm mad at are out dancing. It's pretty good. Frederick Buechner puts it this way. He says, of the seven deadly sins, anger is possibly the most fun. To lick your wounds, to smack your lips over grievances long past, to roll over your tongue the prospect of bitter confrontations still to come, to savor that last toothsome morsel, both the pain you are given and the pain you are giving back. In many ways, it is a feast fit for a king. The chief drawback is that what you are wolfing down is yourself. The skeleton at the feast is you. The skeleton at the feast is you. Abram had an axe to grind, and only through faith could he overcome it. You know, the perfect example of our ability to put away hurts of the past is Jesus Christ. And I want you to turn to 1 Peter chapter 2, where we see his example. 1 Peter chapter 2. First Peter chapter 2 shows us the attitude that Jesus Christ took, and that is the attitude that faith calls for us to take. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21, we read these words, "To this you were called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving an example that you should follow in his steps." In other words, Christ suffered, and your suffering ought to be in the same way, or you ought to suffer in the same way Christ did. And how did he suffer? Well, the text tells us. In verse 22, he committed no sin. He suffered, but he didn't commit any sin. And no deceit was found in his mouth. And when they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, and here's the key, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Now, who is the one who judges justly? It's God. Jesus Christ entrusted himself to God, and that is the faith issue. Jesus Christ said, I believe God so much that you are going to take care of these hurts of the past. That if there's wrongs to be righted, then you'll be the judge of those. If there are people to be punished, then you'll take care of that punishment. If there are sins that have been committed, then you'll deal with those sins. It's not my responsibility to carry this. It's yours. I trust you. You see, the person of faith says, God, I know that in your sovereign love, that you have allowed this hurt to come into my life. I don't know why. I don't know what good it is. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. But I know that you're a good God and you have allowed this. And I'm going to trust that you will also take care of it. That you will also deal with the people that hurt me. That you will take care of all of those things that have come up. And I'm just going to let it go. I'm going to let it go. This is not going to control my life. It is not going to control my life. That's what Jesus Christ did. Let's go on. Verse 24. He himself bore whose sins? In his own body on the tree. Our sins. You know who is the offender here? You know who is the person who inflicted the hurt? You know who is the person that did something terrible to Jesus? It was me and you. He bore our sins. The trust that he had was trusting that God would deal with us. And so how did he respond to us? In incredible love. He bore our sins. Those very people that inflicted the pain, he carried their sins. What an incredible testimony. What incredible faith. Goes on to say, in his body on the tree, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you have been healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your soul. Faith says, I can trust you, God, that you'll take care of the hurts of the past, and I can let them go. I will not let that dominate my life. I trust you, God, to deal with it. Faith wins the internal war with past bitterness, and that was the first battle that Abram had to win before he could respond when he was needed. The second battle that I believe Abram fought and won is Abram, through faith, wins the internal war with personal commitments. He wins the internal war with personal commitments. Abram made two personal commitments in this passage, and in both cases he was sorely tested not to follow through on those, and he does in both cases. Notice in chapter 14 of Genesis that this person that he goes out to rescue is Lot, his nephew. Verse 12, they carried off Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions. Now, according to all that's right in ancient Near Eastern life, Abram, as a fellow clan member or someone who is related, was responsible to try to help out his kinfolk in a time of trouble. But there were a lot of reasons not to do that. I mean, this was one commitment that if any smart man was not going to keep, Abram wouldn't have kept this one. I mean, think about the situation he was going into. Here's a guy with 318 trained men and three other helpers or three other clans that are going to now go and fight an international force who just beat five kings. And he's going to go fight these guys. When Abram made that commitment to follow through, he was giving up everything. Possibly his men, his livelihood, his life, his family, his wife. I mean, this was a situation where he was going to lose it all to keep this commitment. If God didn't step in and help him, it was over for him. And yet he followed through on it. Yet he followed through on it. He kept his commitment. Now, I guess the struggle in him was probably an incredible internal struggle. Why would I ever do this for a guy who got himself in this trouble? I mean, Lot put himself in harm's way, and I can hear the reasoning going on in his mind. He made his own bed. Let him lie in it. Why should I risk everything to save my nephew? And yet he does. Second commitment that he makes, seen in verse 22. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord, the God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and I have taken an oath. Here's my oath. That I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or a thong of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, I made Abram rich. Abram promised God, God, if you deliver me from this battle, I will give you the credit. And now the king of Sodom wants to give him this money, which in essence would be saying, well, Abram really didn't do it for God. He really did it for the cash. He really did it for the financial gain. But it was a lot of money. I mean, I deserve it, don't I? I worked for it, didn't I? I'm the one who took all the risk. Shouldn't I have this? And Abram says no. He made a commitment to God that God would get the credit for this battle and not himself. I bet there was a tremendous internal struggle. I mean, think of what all you could buy with that money. You could probably air condition every one of the tents out there. I mean, there are a lot of things that wealth buys, including protection, including mercenaries. We'll find out next week in chapter 15, Abraham wakes up and says, oh my God, what have I done? I just defeated an international force, and guess what's going to happen in the 15th year? Or at least that's what he's thinking in his mind. Wait till these guys go back home and regroup. What am I going to face next year? We'll see that next week. Abram says, I'm going to follow my commitment to my nephew and to God, even though it cost me greatly. You know, as we look at our culture today and as we look at ourselves, keeping commitments is probably not ranking up there highly in things that we're good at. In fact, as we look at how we deal with our marriages and just the rising rate of divorce among us, as we look at the difficulties when it comes to doing business in today's world where a legal contract is pages and pages and pages long, where it used to be a handshake. And if you didn't get your attorney and your attorney's attorney and your attorney's attorney to read over it, you may leave yourself liable. Because there's always a loophole in every commitment that's ever made. We look at the commitment between parents and kids, and just so many areas where we fall short in following through on our commitments. That's a significant sin. To say I'm going to do something, to commit to something righteous and then not follow through. We also see it in our own Christian lives, where we've committed to walk the path of God. Maybe we've made a vow to God that we will spend time in His Word or that we'll reach out to our lost neighbors, and then later on we fall away from that commitment. I think our society has bought into a concept that William Raspberry states in a column that he writes. William Raspberry is by no means a tremendous conservative, but I think he hits the nail on the head with these words. He's talking about the Ten Commandments, and he's referring to a book that was written, Why Johnny Can't Tell Right from Wrong, Moral Illiteracy and the Case for Character and Education. And he basically says, since we've removed moral training from education, nobody knows what morals are anymore. And he cites the example of the Ten Commandments. And he asks the question, how many of you, could name all 10 commandments right now? Could you name them? What do you think? Do you know all 10 of them? As you're racking your brain on number 2? Remember now, the 10 commandments, those are the commandments authored by God. In His divine penmanship, as He wrote those on the tablets to be given to Moses. It's recorded twice in the Bible. And it's full, the Ten Commandments. Do we really know the moral pinnings on which our society, on which our lives, on which our Christian faith is built? Raspberry makes this comment. He says it all started with the liberal idea that how we feel is more important than what we do. Feeling is inherently individual, and to focus on how we feel is to free ourselves of concern for others, except insofar as looking after others makes us feel good about ourselves. The path from feeling good to self-indulgence is short and smooth. You can get there, our children got there, without even thinking about it. And I agree with what he's saying there. Once we, as people, begin to care more about how we feel than what is right and wrong, we put more emphasis on how we feel about something than looking at doing the right thing, then all of our commitments go down the drain. I'm sure there were mornings when they were chasing these guys through the dusty, hot, rocky areas of northern Palestine, waiting to ambush and surprise this army that Abram didn't feel like being there. There were a lot of times in looking at his military strategy where he probably said, man, this is never going to work. And if he based his decision on feelings, boy, it's easy to bail out. And every day when we get up in the morning and we check our feeling barometer and we decide whether we're going to follow God or whether we're not going to follow God on the basis of how we feel today, whether we're going to forgive our neighbors, whether we're going to love our spouses, whether we're going to spend time with our kids, whether we're going to be honest at work, based on how we feel, we've set ourselves up for a tremendous downfall. Are feelings important? They're absolutely important. But what's more important? Truth, integrity, doing the right thing. Faith says that if I do what God asks me to do, He will make sure. He will make sure that things work out the way He wants them to work out. If God really exists and He's given us a set of guidelines to live by, faith says I can live by those guidelines, I can live by that direction, even though I might not feel like it. And faith overcomes that internal struggle with personal commitment. Finally, we see the last internal war that faith wins for Abram. He wins the internal war with personal profit. The internal war with personal profit. Abram's now in the valley of decision. He's got two kings that appear, and each of them make him a different offer. And the basis of those offers strike at the fundamental root of who he is. Notice, the one king, verse 18, then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram. Now, who was this guy? And we've got just a few verses about him here in the Old Testament. And then we find out throughout the rest of the Bible that he was a pretty important person. In fact, we see him in Psalms 110, where David says that Melchizedek, that Jesus is going to be after the line of Melchizedek, the Messiah. We see in Hebrews chapter 6 and 7 how important Melchizedek is. And a lot of people speculate, well, you know, if this guy's so important, how come we don't know more about him? Who is he? Well, some have suggested that maybe he's a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Jesus Christ, before he came in flesh and was born to Mary, appeared as this man Melchizedek. That's a possible interpretation. A lot of people take that view. I particularly don't take that. I think that he's a real historical figure. In fact, as you look at the text, then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He's from the city of Salem. He's the king of Salem. And everything in the context would sound historical. First of all, the city of Salem is the Jebusite city, which David will eventually conquer and set up as the capital of the nation of Israel. We know it today as what? Jerusalem. The word Salem is a cognate of the Hebrew word shalom, for peace. So he's got a historical place. The name Melchizedek, Melech, comes from the Hebrew word king, and Zedek comes from the Hebrew word righteousness, and this king has taken a title to describe himself, king of righteousness. Not only that, but the text says that he was a priest of God Most High, El Elyon, the Most High God. And he comes out with wine and bread. Could it be that he's foreshadowing the communion? This man comes out, and who is he? I believe that he's a Jebusite king, and I believe that he's a holdover from Noah in the belief in the true God. You see, after the world was destroyed by water and Noah came off the ark, the remembrance of all of ancient history was contained in that man Noah, and he passed it down to his sons through oral tradition. Eventually, the race as a whole began to get away, and we saw in chapter 11, the Tower of Babel, when the race divided, and people went off and developed all kinds of pagan religions. And I believe in the middle of the land of Canaan, there's one pocket of true believers left, and Melchizedek is their king. Now, how long they stay true believers, we don't know. How long that they hold to the truth, we don't know. But one thing we do know is that Abram recognized Melchizedek as his spiritual superior. Here is the man, and this is humbling, you men who consider yourselves spiritual leaders, who serve as elders and deacons and teachers, women who consider yourself well-grounded in the Word. Can you learn from someone else? here's the man, Abram, who the promise has been given to. This guy's got the promise. The land has been given to him. He is the hope of the world. He's going to be the great nation. Everything's going to come through him. And Melchizedek shows up and blesses him through God. And what does he do? He gives him a tithe. He recognizes that Melchizedek is his spiritual superior. And he offers him a tithe. Notice what Melchizedek says. Here's the offer. He says, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hands." In other words, Abram, God did this. Will you give him credit for it? Will you give him credit for it? King of Sodom, on the other hand, from that wicked city, is thinking about the bottom line. He says, "You give me the people," verse 21, "and keep the goods for yourself." What will Abram do? Abram's faced with that third internal battle, that third internal demon, that demon of personal prophets. That demon of personal prophets. Will I put my hope by faith in what God will do for me in the future? Or do I grab the prophets that are offered to me, tainted as they might be, in today and secure myself? What's the choice going to be? The most, I think, obvious example of this in modern times occurred a few years ago when a certain televangelist made the plea over the airwaves that if he did not raise $8 million, in other words, if you didn't send in enough money to give $8 million, that God was going to take his life. And he made that very public. It was on all the national networks. It was in Newsweek magazine. His statement was, if I don't raise $8 million, God is going to kill me. He's going to take me home. And he made that very, very public. Well, people all around the country who didn't want to see this evangelist die started sending in their money. But the person who stands out among the list of those who sent in the money comes from a completely different background than this televangelist. In fact, the person who sent in the money was actually a 79-year-old 10th grade dropout from Sarasota, Florida, who made his millions and millions of dollars in parimutuel betting and gambling. He owned dog tracks, he owned horse tracks, and predominantly had lived a life which most people would consider very irreligious at best. I know a person who knew this man personally, and he was not what you would consider the pillar of Christianity and evangelical faith. Well, when he heard that this televangelist was going to die if he didn't get the $8 million, he figured out how much money the televangelist needed and wrote a check for $1.3 million. And guess what? Did the televangelist take the money? You bet he did. Tainted or not. I guess if God told me he was going to kill me in the next month, I'd probably take the money too. Notice what he said. This man, speaking about his gift, said, "He," that's the televangelist, "is trying to convert souls, and all I'm trying to do is do business with them." Later on, one of his spokesmen said he decided they wouldn't have to pray anymore. Their prayers were answered. He ripped a check out of his personal checkbook and gave it to me, told me to fill it out, and then he signed it. People have said to me, "Hey, wouldn't it be neat if somebody at Hill Country Bible Church won the lottery? Then we could build our building across the street and pay cash for it, and wouldn't that be neat?" By the way, did any of y'all win the $55 million lottery last night? You know what we'd have to say if that happened? If somebody won the lottery and we build our building on the basis of that, or Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes, or whatever, and we build our building on that, we could say, "Isn't it great that the state of Texas," the lottery players of the state of Texas have built our building for us. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful that Ed McMahon built our building for us instead of God building our building for us? For you see, in order for us to build that building, it's going to require prayer. It's going to require commitment. It's going to require sacrifice. It's going to require ownership. All of those things that the Bible values. Not some easy, quick, tainted approach to wealth.